In this hour of our show, we will bring you the story of an American empire. It is a familiar tale of expansion and conquest, but with a reversal of roles. It's a story in which Indians expand and prosper, and European colonists resist and struggle to survive. It is the lost story of the Comanches, a people that, for a century, between 1750 and 1850, were the dominant people of the Southwest. And it's a story that offers a new model for thinking about the history of relations between the natives and Europeans in North America. Our guest is Pekka Hämäläinen. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Santa Barbara and is author of a book that explores this subject, and it's very interesting. The title is Comanche, The Comanche Empire, and it's published by the Yale University Press. Is out now, and if you'd like to read the book, you can seek it out in the bookstore or the library. And, of course, this morning, as always, your questions are welcome. We just ask people who are calling in to keep their questions brief so we can keep moving along. But anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So, at any point here, your questions and comments are certainly welcome. Professor Hämäläinen, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I think this is a very interesting story, and that one of the questions I'm prompted to ask first is, why is it that it's a story that we really don't know, or that many people would say, well, as they listen and get a sense of the Comanches, they would say, well, I feel as if I'm hearing this for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think it's a combination of reasons, really. You know, I think the main reason why we haven't seen or recognized this the extent of Comanche power or this Comanche empire before is, you know, how we've seen the Indians as historical actors. You know, we have saw the Indians as basically local historical actors and basically resisting European colonialism, and we really, you know, couldn't imagine Indians doing politically, economically much beyond that. And the second reason I think we haven't perhaps seen the empire, the Comanche empire, is the what you might call historical short-sightedness. Mm. You know, when the Anglo-Americans first entered the Southwest in large numbers in the mid-19th century, the Comanche Empire was already gone. It had collapsed. And most Americans thought, you know, this is how the region, the Comanches, the Indians had always been, you know, basically frozen in time. And they couldn't sort of imagine. They ignored the history that had gone before. So those are, you know, some of the explanations, perhaps, why we haven't seen it or imagined this kind of dynamics before.
I'm sure that we will want to define the terms empire, and you also use the term imperialism, mm-hmm. in the Comanche context, because here we are talking about something that, when you look at their political organization, it was different from what we're used to thinking of when we use those words empire and imperialism in a European context.
Oh, absolutely, and it is you know, it's not an empire in the, you know, traditional sense, mm-hmm. of the word. It's not a European type empire with a single central authority or, you know, large settlement colonies and ostentatious art or architecture and those things that usually define, you know, traditional empires like British Empire and so forth. But at the same time, you know, the Comanches do have, you know, the power system the Comanches built did have many of their defining features of which we usually associate with the empires and imperial powers, and so that sort of. I suppose what I'm saying is that, you know, to understand Comanches as an imperial power, as an empire, we sort of have to rethink what an empire as a concept is as well.
Mm-hmm. At the height of their influence, mm-hmm. How much territory would you say that they held sway over?
Well, directly they held sway over the Comanche territory, Comancheria, as the Spaniards called it, encompassed about 250,000 square miles, which is the by far the largest native territory in North America. And it was larger than the 13 colonies at the time, you know, larger than Central America alone. So it's a massive, massive territory. But this sphere of influence actually expanded all the way from almost from Mexico City to the Canadian plains up in the north. So, and these are the regions where the economic power is prominent and where they raided and moved almost at will. Yeah. So it's really a, you know, their power system had a sort of continental, even hemispheric dimension.
And as far as their relations with some of the other imperial powers, the other empires that they dealt with, America, with Mexico, and so forth, it seems that one of their strong advantages was that here their center of power was far from the centers of power of the Americas, the Americans, or of the Mexicans. That is, it was at the fringes of their empire, and their ability to extend their power was somewhat limited. For the Comanches, that was a great advantage.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at, for example, Spanish New Mexico and Spanish Texas, they're almost like, peripheries between two imperial powers, two imperial centers, one being Comancheria and the other being Mexico City. And they're sort of caught between these two imperial centers. Mexico City sort of, you know, in some ways ignoring them, and the Comanches from the other side exploiting and dominating them. So it is true, but at the same time, you know, I don't think the Comanche power and dominance in the Southwest was only a function of European weakness. You know, these were highly contested territories, the Southern Plains and the mid-continent between the Spaniards and the French and later the Americans and so forth. So it was, intensely contested region, yeah, where Europeans desperately tried to wield power and dominate and control.
And I think one interesting point here that you make is that you can certainly see the important role that the Comanches played here in a sense, determining the future history of both Mexico and the United States, because you say that in part the answer to the question, why is it that Texas and the southwestern United States is the United States and not part of northern Mexico, part of the answer to that question is the Comanches.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it goes all the way back to the, you know, the early stages of Comanche expansion in the 18th century. When the Comanche started to expand, they did much of the expansion at the expense of the Spanish Empire. And they, you know, exploited Spanish colonial outposts through raiding and diplomacy and so forth. And in a sense, they blocked Spanish expansion into the continent center. And during the Mexican period, after 1821, the Comanches kept exploiting and dominating these regions in New Mexico and Texas, and even south of Rio Grande. And they critically weakened these regions and basically softened them, made them much weaker. And in that sense, you know, paved the way for America's expansion into these regions in the early 19th century. So Comanche expansion and American expansion in many ways intertwined and supported one another in unexpected ways.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Pekka Hämäläinen. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Santa Barbara. The book, if you'd like to read it, is The Comanche Empire. It's published by the Yale University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The Comanches did not originate in the Southwest. From where did they come, and how is it that they came to be here in the territory that we're talking about? And again, this is essentially much of present-day Texas, Oklahoma, and some of the surrounding states.
Absolutely. Well, initially they started their long migrations towards the Southern Plains from the Great Basin region, and they first entered the Great Plains further north on the central plains, and gradually in the late 1600s and early 1700s, they started to migrate southward, largely because horses had become available from New Mexico after the Great Pueblo Revolt of 1680, when the Spaniards fled New Mexico and retreated south and left much of their horse wealth in the hands of the Pueblo Indians, who then started trading these horses among the surrounding nomadic tribes. And Comanches encountered this northward pushing horse frontier and basically just decided to trace that horse flow back to its source in New Mexico. And that's how gradually they pushed to the south. And it was basically a commonplace migration. You know, we have seen these kind of migrations over and over across North America. But it was this particular migration that then escalated into a much larger colonial, even imperial project.
Certainly there were people here, indigenous people living in this territory when the Comanches started to move in. How was it possible for them to dominate the people that were already living there?
Well, the main group or groups living in the southern plains were the various Apache groups. There was many of them groups, and which were sort of semi-sedentary people who were just starting to experiment with more and more intensive agriculture, and the Comanches who invaded basically became, when they adopted horses, they became specialized nomadic bison hunters. And they were able to use horsepower and all the advantages horses offered them militarily and in terms of transportation and so forth, much more fully than the Apaches. And they acquired a huge military advantage over the Apache groups. And over a 50-year period or so, from the 1710s until 1760s, they waged almost unrelentless war against the various Apache groups, pushing them gradually to the south and west, and basically demolishing or eradicating this once flourishing Apache plains culture. That's why we find the Apaches later in the south, further southwest, in Arizona and south of Rio Grande.
You write in the introduction that while this empire was powered by violence, those were the words that you use, it was also, it was first and foremost an economic construction. Perhaps you could talk about economic relations and trade relations between the Comanches and the surrounding peoples, the other people that they had in contact with, both indigenous people and also Europeans.
And that's exactly, this economic power, commercial power, is the core of the Comanche Empire. That's what allows Comanches to become so powerful. You know, basically, Comanches built a massive trading empire that mantled much of the mid-continent. And the reason why they were able to do so was largely because they dominated. They could control the diffusion of horses from the southwest to these northern and eastern regions, especially to the northern plains, where the Indians had considerable difficulties in building viable horse cultures because the climate was too harsh and the winters were too cold and so forth, and they needed to replenish their horse herds all the time. And the main source for horses was Comancheria. And so over time, starting in the late 18th century, the Comanches basically drew most of the surrounding tribes of the Great Plains on their commercial orbit. And that also gave them access to European technology, carbohydrates, and all the crucial goods, but also it gave them political power, and it pacified their border regions. And in that sense, Comancheria, actually, the southern plains under Comanche rule, become one of the most peaceful, tranquil places in early America.
So as far as I'm interested in this sort of relationship between their being traders as agents, that is sort of the middleman, so to speak, and and to the extent to which they had a product that they produced and controlled. So it sounds as if in that category, the main thing would indeed be horses. Were there other things that they you would say that they produced, or was it, apart from that, the fact that they had control over the territory and that they, in a sense, could be in the middle of any transaction between two other parties?
Well, it's two things. Location is crucial for them because they do control that sort of middle region between supply and demand of livestock. You know, between the supply in the Spanish and Mexican Southwest and then the demand farther north. So that's crucial. But horses were the foundation of the economy and their trading empire. But also there was two other crucial Comanche exports. One was the bison products, dried meats and hides, which the Comanches, being specialized hunters, traded to the surrounding agricultural societies, and in exchange got the crucial carbohydrates that allowed them to balance their diets and keep their population up. So bison products was a crucial commodity as well. And finally, captives and slaves, which they largely took again from Spanish Southwest and northern Mexico and then traded them to surrounding native groups and also to French Louisiana and beyond.
That was significant with the Comanches, that is, their involvement in slave trade, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And, it's... especially in the early part, it was essential to their trading system, basically slave trade. But over time, when the Comanches, reinvent themselves as a horse pastoralist, horses come to define their very way of life. The Comanches start to decrease their trading captives, and they absorbed most of the slaves and most of the captives into their own society and used them as laborers to support this expanding pastoral economy. So that the slave trade actually decreases in many ways as the Comanche power grows over time.
There, I think that you touch on something interesting, and it's a way in which the Comanches perhaps were different from other Indian peoples, and that is their willingness to take outsiders into their society.
Oh, absolutely. And, that's, again, one of the key factors sort of that, in my mind, allow us to look at the Comanches as an imperial power, because the Comancheria, the Comanche territory, becomes, especially in the 19th century, increasingly multicultural. Comanches incorporate people. Many people actually, migrated to Comancheria voluntarily, from the Wichita Indians from the east, Arapahos, Kiowas from the north. Even Spanish settlers and Mexican settlers would leave their homelands and basically immigrate among the Comanches, drawn by the prestige and wealth and power of the Comanches. And in that sense, Comancheria becomes through this ethnic incorporation. Becomes increasingly multicultural. Another aspect, of course, is this increasing or growing slave system, slave economy the Comanches are building. And the Comanches basically become the largest slave owners in the Southwest, actually probably in entire American West.
Perhaps you can talk about the political organization of the Comanche state, because it was... It was, in one sense, a kind of a cohesive state, and yet on the other, it was made up of autonomous groups. There really was no overarching central authority. There was no one person who had the title of chief or king or emperor or whatever that you want to use. What in the sense, was there much in the way of central authority, and how did then the various autonomous groups that made up Comancheria relate and organize and one another and deal with issues of who was going to be in control and so forth?
And that really is a crucial question here, isn't it? In many ways, because the Comanches were nomadic and they moved around, they were extremely mobile, and because of questions of problems with horse pastoralism and forage and pasture and so forth, they had to live in small bands, small units that were scattered around Comancheria. And in that sense, they were, very decentralized. And there was, like you said, no one single center or one single person in power. But at the same time, the Comanches would periodically, every year actually, you know, during winters and in the summer, gather together into massive divisional and interdivisional meetings where, you know, you might have 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 Comanches coming together for a few weeks. To basically, you know, make crucial decisions, political decisions. That there were always, you know, large-scale political councils where all the men were allowed to participate. And it's these, you know, inclusive large-scale political councils that really give the cohesion to the Comanche political foreign policy. And they give a rise to what I call in the book a Comanche Confederacy. Mm-hmm. So it's periodic. You can't see it all the time. They are not centralized all the time, but seasonally and periodically, they are.
We are very close to our midpoint here. Again, I'd like to introduce our guest, Pekka Hämäläinen. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Santa Barbara, where he teaches and does research on U.S. history and Native American history. He is the author of a book that is all about the history of the Comanche Empire, and that is, in fact, the title of the book. It is published by the Yale University Press. You can seek it out in bookstore and library. And it is, indeed, the story of the Comanche Empire for roughly 100 years between 750 and 1850, the Comanches were the dominant people of the Southwest. And their story is rather different from the one that we have come to know and hear, story dealing with the relations between the indigenous people of the Americans and the Europeans who came here. The people came from Spain, who came from elsewhere in Europe, the French, the British, and so forth. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. How did particularly the government, the Spanish government, and the American government think about the Comanche Empire?
Well, the Spaniards, especially, struggled to gain some sort of control, to somehow protect their frontiers from Comanche raiding and from Comanche exploitation. And military retaliation was soon became clear, you know, military response was impossible. The Comanches just had too big of an advantage in terms of equestrian power, and also they had too many guns. They had more guns than the Spanish settlers and soldiers around them. So they tried diplomacy, and they tried to basically co-opt Comanche leadership through special privileges, through gifts, through special attention, and so forth and so forth. And the Spaniards especially thought that they had succeeded at various points of sort of corrupting, co-opting Comanche leadership. But, you know, in reality, the Comanche leadership played dual roles. You know, they projected this image of submission sometimes and cooperation to the Spanish officials, but at the same time they made no attempts to interfere with the or change the Comanche policies within Comancheria. Comanches continued throughout their dominant imperial tenure to make decisions autonomously.
Did they have some sense that they, in a sense, that they were an empire, and this was an empire of indigenous people, and to the extent that they could hold that together and perhaps forge alliances with other indigenous people, that they could, in a sense, hold their own against the truly imperial powers from Europe?
Oh, absolutely. And they felt, you know, especially until 1840s, and when the empire starts to gradually collapse and disintegrate, they absolutely felt superior to the Spanish and the Mexican and even you know, Republic of Texas and the Americans. I mean, they did not think of themselves as an empire in a sense, in the European sense of the word. They didn't use the word empire, but they definitely felt that the Southern Plains belonged to them, and they definitely felt that it was their privilege to cross the Rio Grande, raid deep into northern Mexico, into Mexican jungles, basically, and they considered those as their rights and their privilege, and in many ways. In central Mexico, in northern Mexico, in the Bolton, the Mapimi region, they actually held what might be called even a quasi-settlement colony, a staging area for the wide-ranging raids in northern Mexico, and the Comanches would live year-round in this region. So they did definitely feel that they wielded massive interregional power, or they didn't necessarily conceive themselves as an imperial power per se.
Yeah. Well, they certainly did control the plains. I mean, that's something that not only did they feel it, it was true. Although I suppose what's interesting here is that particularly when you make comparisons between, say, Mexico and the people who were living there and the Americans, that the way that these various peoples, particularly the European and the indigenous people, thought about political power and how that was demonstrated and how that was exercised was very different, and how it is people determined wealth was very different. And I imagine that made it difficult for the people from both societies to, in a sense, understand the other, because some of their very basic, most basic assumptions would have been very different.
Oh, absolutely. You know, take, for example, gifts. Which the Spaniards would, you know, throughout their history with the Comanches, they would always give gifts to Comanches, distribute gifts to Comanches, hoping that, you know, the gifts would sort of induce allegiance, some sort of submission to the Spanish Empire. But the Comanches, at the same time, you know, conceived these gifts not as political tools, but as basically. As tools for turning strangers into fictive relatives. Hmm. And that created all kinds of confusion. Comanches expected this gift to be available all the time. If the Spaniards failed to give gifts, the Comanches would think that the Spaniards loved them less and became strangers again. And when they became strangers, they could be raided and exploited as strangers, and that dynamic gave a rise to, you know, what I call in the book is the Comanche tribute system. They expected a continuous supply of gifts from New Mexico and Texas and northern Mexico, and if they were denied, they would raid and retaliate. And so the Spaniards were basically forced to continuously supply gifts to the Comanches, and these gifts basically became just tribute payments for buying peace. And it's those kind of, you know, cultural misunderstandings, conflicts, really at the core of these power relations. And it is the Spaniards and the Mexicans and Americans and the French who, by and large, yield and have to adopt the Comanche cultural modes and Comanche ways of doing things. And in that sense, Comanches also wielded, like empires do, you know, soft power, cultural power. They were able to force other peoples to accept and even perhaps internalize their own cultural modes and norms.
Hmm. Can one see any of that remaining? Did that have any more than a temporary kind of impact on the culture of the Southwest?
Well, in some sense, you know, it's difficult. You know, the political map of the Southwest, I think you cannot understand, you know, how the map looks today without, you know, having Comanches in the story, actually at the center of the story. The fact that, you know, Texas and New Mexico are today part of the United States, the Comanches played a huge role in the process that, you know, established the borders where they are. But also, you might say that, you know, it's the Comanche legacy is also seen in the ethnic landscape of New Mexico of the Southwest in many ways, because the Comanche, especially the Comanche slave system, and the Comanches would adopt captives and from New Mexico and Texas, and basically reorganize and break these kinship structures that were there, promoting ethnic blending in the Southwest. Ethnic blending and reorganization is still visible in many ways in the Southwest, because when the Anglo-Americans enter the region, they have hard time of distinguishing the Mexican population from the Comanches in many ways, because of these long-lasting traditions of slave raiding and kinship adoption and so forth. And the Anglo officials and Anglo authorities tended to sort of associate Mexicanness with Indianness. And in that sense, you know, they sort of, the Mexicans were perhaps denied access to the, you know, the privileges of the new Anglo society.
I'm sure that one of the challenges that is faced by historians and anthropologists and other people who are interested in studying the history of the indigenous people of the Americas, particularly the part of the country we're talking about, the West, is the lack of source material that originated with those people.
Mm-hmm.
What is there? Is there primary source material that you were able to take advantage of that actually comes out of the Comanche Empire and Comanche society?
Well, you know, there's basically the basic method what I was using in the book is what's called ethnohistorical method, in which, you know, we have traditional historical sources and archival sources from Spanish, Mexican, American archives, and then we compare those sources to the ethnographic information and the oral traditions of the indigenous peoples. And some of the Comanche oral histories and are available, and they have been printed and they have been analyzed. And those oral traditions were really sort of the filter through which I interpreted these more traditional archival sources. In that sense, it makes it possible to see, get glimpses at least of how Comanches viewed and understood things like commerce, diplomacy, gift-giving, raiding, violence, and loyalty, and so forth and so forth.
Our guest in this hour, Pekka Hämäläinen, is Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He teaches and does research on U.S. history and Native American history, and is the author of the book, The Comanche Empire. It is published by the Yale University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we talked about just for a long period of time, for something like 100 years, the Comanches were, from 1750 to 1850, they were the dominant people of the Southwest, but eventually the Comanche Empire did decline. What happened?
Well, you know, and that's interesting in many ways, because traditionally, you know, empires tend to fall. The collapse tends to come from within. And, you know, the empires usually, start declining for various internal reasons until, you know, outside forces come and, sort of deliver a coup de grace. And that's the same dynamic that happens with the Comanches. You know, if you look at the timeline, you know, it might appear that the Comanches, the Comanche power waned and declined when Americans enter the Southwest, when the United States enters the Southwest. But that's sort of because the Comanche Empire really starts to decline in the late 1840s, and by the late 1850s, it's basically gone. There's no empire. The Comanches are still there, and they are still a strong people and a strong nation, but they don't have an empire anymore. And at the same time, we see the Americans coming into Texas, to New Mexico, and establishing their control in these regions. And we might sort of link these developments, but that's sort of a misconception. And because the Comanches had already, before the Americans come there, they had already collapsed. And it's basically, you know, by and large, an ecological problem. The Comanches had basically just become too successful for their own good. The production system, the pastoral economy, was too heavy for the relatively fragile grassland ecology of the southern plains, and the vast horse herds the Comanches had competed with the bison, buffalo, for grass and water and shelter and so on. And gradually in the 1830s and 40s, the buffalo herds began to decline. And with that, also the Comanche population began to decline, and that sort of triggers off a chain reaction, which gradually dismantles the Comanche power system.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose we should just note for the benefit of people listening that, in fact, there are still Comanches.
Oh, absolutely.
There still is a Comanche nation, so it does exist, and that today there are Comanches who live in New Mexico and Colorado and Kansas and Oklahoma and Texas, in that same part of the world.
Oh, absolutely, and it's a in many ways a thriving nation. It's about my understanding it's about 10,000 members. So the Comanches are defeated in 1875, and there's about perhaps less than 2,000 Comanches at that point, at that low point in their history. But the Comanche empire, the Comanche nation, did endure, and they are in many ways growing and thriving again.
At the beginning, we talked a little bit about how it is that this is a story that maybe hasn't been fully told or people aren't familiar with, and that one of the reasons that it's important is that it adds to and makes more rich and complex the story of the relations between the Europeans who came to the Americans and the indigenous people who were here. And that this is, again, this story, it's very different from when you talk about the power relationships here. It's very different from the kind of story that we've come to know and hear and be used to.
Mm-hmm.
How now does the story of the Comanche Empire enter into or maybe shape or refine our understanding of this period in American history and of relations between the Europeans and indigenous people?
Well, in many ways, one reason is if we start with the relations between the Spaniards and the Comanches, in many ways you could argue you cannot understand how Spanish imperialism, Spanish colonialism, evolved in North America without putting Comanches back into the picture. It's basically the failure of Spaniards to expand and build a North American empire in Central North America. Was a result of Comanche expansion, and then, as we already talked about, the fact that Mexico was unable to hold on to its North American possessions, New Mexico and Texas, that failure again cannot be understood without Comanche power and Comanche empire in the picture. And again, American expansion, because the Americans basically just, when they expanded westward and took Texas and took New Mexico in the 1830s and 40s, in many ways, the United States sort of happened to stumble into these pre-existing imperial niches, places the Comanches had already weakened and conquered, and basically softened them and made them easier for the Americans to conquer and incorporate. So in that sense, it really does sort of force us to rethink who and which forces move history, and it, usually we look at North American history from its fringes to the interior, from Jamestown, from Washington D.C., from Mexico City, inward towards the interior, and we look at how power basically just flows into one direction from the edges to the center of the continent. But I would argue we can sort of turn the lens around and start with from the center of the continent, from the indigenous societies, and look at how they project power and influence these these large scale historical processes and some determine events and outcomes.
Was there ever a time when Americans looked at the Comanche nation, the Comanche Empire, and said, in a sense, said, well, we need to negotiate with them virtually state to state and acknowledge the fact that they are in what, in our terms, that it does constitute what we would call a state. And so we would say, all right, let's just acknowledge their existence rather than trying to conquer them, live with them as, in a sense, one nation to another or one empire to another.
Oh, that's a great question. Spanish Empire and the Spaniards and the Republic of Mexico, they did exactly that. They wouldn't consider all Indians on their borders as states or nations, but the Comanches, they always did, especially from the late 18th century on. They would always talk about the Comanches as a nation. And, when Mexico became independent, and they would actually bring a Comanche envoy, Comanche emissaries to Mexico City to see the establishment of the new Mexican state, and they wanted the Comanches to be part of that process and witness that. So they really treated Comanches as a sovereign nation. But that did not extend beyond 1840s and 1850s, and the United States did not really treat Comanches as a nation, but more as a tribe, one indigenous tribes among others.
Mm. It's interesting to imagine, perhaps that's all one would be doing, but imagine how things might have been different if the Americans had taken a different approach to relating to the Comanches.
How they viewed them as a...
Yes. Yeah, and what I, and how I don't know if that really would want to imagine the American Southwest would be different. It's significantly different than it is now, but if one imagines a different kind of model of the one people relating to the other.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and it might have been different, if the Comanches had been an empire or this kind of interregional power still in the 1850s when the United States really tries to establish its authority in New Mexico and Texas but as I explained earlier, the Comanche power had already collapsed at that point, but had the Comanches been at the height of their power still, it would be, it's an interesting question what would have happened, because obviously, United States government would have had to deal with the Comanches on different terms and acknowledge their power in this region and acknowledge them probably as a nation with which they have to negotiate on more equal basis.
Our guest in this hour is Pekka Hämäläinen. He's an historian. He's associate professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His book is The Comanche Empire. It's published by the Yale University Press. And we have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less in this part of Focus 580. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you would forgive a personal question, I know that you got your PhD at University of Helsinki, so mm-hmm. I'm assuming that you grew up in Finland. How is it that someone in Finland ends up being interested in and a specialist in Native American history?
I'm often asked that question, and I tend to give a different answer every time, probably because I don't know myself that why do we make the life choices we make, but I guess it started with with movies, actually, with the classic westerns and the westerns of the 60s, the movies like The Little Big Man. I was really excited about them, but I also always wanted to see what was behind that Hollywood cardboard image of native peoples. What was the reality beyond that? And that always intrigued me. But Native American American history in general, but also Native American history in particular, is large and thriving field of study in many parts of Europe, like Germany and Scandinavia and Finland. So it's, in that sense, it's not so surprising. perhaps. And I had a choice of doing either European history, you know, in grad school, or American history. Those were my two choices. And this was in the 1990s. And that was the time when the Native American history in the United States was really starting to boom. And there was this, you know, renaissance of Native American studies, which is still going on. And it was in many ways just too strong to resist.
Is there, do you see, this maybe might seem like a strange question, but I guess I wonder whether you see any sort of interesting parallels between relations between the indigenous people of the Americans and the Europeans who came here, and relations between the Sami people who certainly still exist from where you came from, and also the, so they were the indigenous people, and mm-hmm. then also the people who moved in there who became the modern Finnish people.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are parallels, and it is basically, you know, same sort of dynamic as America's westward expansion. In Finland, it would be, you know, the northward expansion of the Finnish people. But the difference is, it's in Finland, you know, this process was much more gradual, and it was much less violent, and it's far in the past. You know, it happened gradually and over millennia. And we don't really know that much about it. And whereas, you know, America's expansion, westward expansion, happened in the, you know, mostly in the 19th century, when, you know, it's so huge documented. So we don't. There's trauma. There's dispossession, violence in Finnish history with the Sami people. But it's not that. In the same way that in the United States, you know, that history, it's not part of the, you know, the national consciousness or the national psyche as it is in the United States. You know, the questions of guilt over the, you know, the fate of the Indians seems, you know, to me as an outsider, seem like a, you know, seem very central to mm-hmm. the American identity.
Well, certainly something that's a contemporary concern. It's a concern there, and I'm sure it's a concern a lot of other places. Is that how is it that can the environment contain indigenous peoples continuing to live in traditional way that they have lived, and that seems to be an increasing challenge. And I think, as far as the Sami are concerned, it's a challenge for them too.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and it's an ongoing struggle, and, you know, how to maintain the indigenous ways of life. You know, their I suppose, advantage to how they are sheltered in some ways from more national forces and national power is the location far in the north. Not too many people want to live there, and in that sense, you know, they might have perhaps more leverage, more opportunities of maintaining their traditional ways of life. Yeah.
Well, we have about 4 minutes left. Returning to the Comanches, just as a way of summing up, let me ask you, pose this question that you deal with obviously throughout the book, but come back to again at mm-hmm. the conclusion, and that is to ask how it is that the Comanches, particularly for this 100-year period, how is it that they have managed to be as successful as they were?
Well, it's obviously a function of many reasons, but if we would identify the sort of the key factors, one would be, I suppose, you know, location. You know, they were located between several imperial spheres. You know, you would have the Spanish and later the Mexicans in their east and south of Comancheria. And on the other side, you know, along the Mississippi Valley, you would have the French, later the British briefly, and later and finally the Americans. And the Comanches would, you know, use this location for their advantage, you know, playing off different colonial powers against one another and extort benefits and concessions from these imperial powers. So location was one of the key elements. But then again, you know, other tribes, other native nations have had those same advantages. And the one of the another key factor was the Comanches' adaptability. You know, they're really, you know, because they came from somewhere else to the southern plains, and they had been forced to do their long migration to adapt to different environments and really, you know, streamline the economic system, which made them extremely adaptive to the these new forces and new conditions in the Southwest, the availability of horses, European gun technology, and so forth and so forth. And being so adaptive and flexible, they were able to harness these new innovations and technologies, I suppose, more efficiently than many of their native neighbors. And especially the horses. I mean, it was really an empire of horses, and the Comanches utilized and exploited equestrian power more fully than any of their native neighbors or native rivals.
Yeah. And again, not to put too fine a point on this, but I think, again, it's interesting to note that then when you talk about the collapse of the Comanche Empire, it was not so much that they were overwhelmed militarily by another power. It was the impact of the way that they lived on the environment just came to the point where the environment wouldn't sustain it anymore.
Oh, absolutely. It was just that sort of grazing competition between the Comanche horse herds and bison, and the bison herds had been going on for decades. And that had sort of gradually weakened the ecological base of Comancheria. But, you know, things really got bad was actually, it was just a climatic intervention. In the southern plains were hit by a prolonged drought in 1845, and it was extremely intensive and long drought that lasted into 1860s, and that was basically that demolished, really pushed the buffalo herds into a steep decline, and it was an ecological crisis from which the Comanches never really recovered.
Well, there we will have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. For people who would like to read more, look for the book that we have mentioned. It's titled The Comanche Empire, and it's published by Yale. They're a fine press, but this is the Yale University Press, and our guest is the author, Pekka Hämäläinen, and he is Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Santa Barbara, where he teaches and does research on U.S. history and Native American history. And Professor Hämäläinen, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.